So probably about 25 years ago now, when I was CTO at a company doing real-time 3D graphics, we were one of 20 companies that Intel had chosen to present at the Web 3D Roundup, which was an event in Los Angeles. There were 3,000 people in the audience, and they were inebriated because there were pre-pitched drinks. They had whoopee cushions to make farting noises if you went over your allocated time, and if your demo crashed or you were boring, they also had ping pong guns to shoot you. Now, I had insisted in our company that I was going to do this demo. My team were in Australia. I was in Atlanta. In LA. And during the rehearsals, our 3D engine kept crashing. I had 3 minutes to talk, and I think it had lasted no more than a minute, so there were frantic calls to Australia to fix the bug ahead of this event. And the company was low on cash, so we also needed to raise funding. So sort of like the future of the company hinged on a good presentation, which had kept crashing, and I had insisted that I was going to do this presentation.
Anthony Rose, welcome to The Everyday Founder. You grew up in Cape Town. You moved to Australia for about 20 years. You then moved to the UK and got enticed by an offer from the BBC. You once got described as the man who saved the BBC. After your time there, you moved on and sold two different businesses. Then you started Seed Legals. Doing that for 7.5 years. Tell me what Seed Legals is and how you got here today.
So, thank you. Seed Legals is a legal tech platform. If you're an early stage startup founder, don't go to a law firm, come to Seed Legals. So, but jokes aside, it's everything you need to get investment ready. There are tons of articles, resources, creating a pitch deck. But when it comes to the funding round, you're going to do all your legals for the funding round on Seed Legals, and the team are there to help. And broadly, as a business, I like to think, what would a law firm do? We'll do exactly the opposite. And we can dive into that, but that's fun.
Amazing, amazing. So South Africa, Australia, now the UK. What is the bit of the UK that you enjoy the most versus those other two nations?
London is just so happening. I live in the city, in the central London, and I can run everywhere. I ran here. So it's just fantastic that, you know, if you're in LA, you're going to spend most of your life on the awful, you know, 101 freeway or the 405, whichever it is. In Sydney, it's glorious. The beaches are fantastic, but very little happens. London, everything happens, and it's, you know, in a short space, and it's fantastic.
Apart from potentially the good weather.
The sun is a little bit more of an issue for some of the time, I agree.
Absolutely. So let's move back to the BBC. Something that is used over 6.5 billion times a year in terms of streams is something you designed, which is the iPlayer. Tell me about that.
So, I mean, I didn't design it. I helped launch it. So the BBC had been noodling over this idea of, you know, the stuff you see on television. Can you watch it on your phone at a different time? And they've been noodling over it for quite some years. It was visionary on their side. But the execution was lacking. And so I knew Eric Huggers, who headed up BBC's digital. I was living in Australia. We'd met at various events, and he said, how would you like to join the BBC? And I went, the BBC, where are the stock options? But I was tempted and flew over to London. And the state of the project, it wasn't really consumer-friendly. It was a bit of a mess. And I thought I would need to fire the tech team because it was a bit of a disaster. It turns out the tech team were brilliant. The problem was, and I think this is a problem in many companies, is they were not optimizing for what the customer wanted. They were optimizing for what the editorial department wanted or what BBC One wanted or BBC Two wanted. And so to resolutely focus on the customer, and to this day, customer-driven development is, you know, an obsession for me.
Mm. So interesting. When you moved away from the BBC, you started one business called Beamly.
Yep.
You then sold that business. You then moved on to another business called Six Tribes. You sold that business again to three characters that, especially those in the UK, know very well, which is the original Top Gear hosts. So you're Jeremy Clarkson, Richard Hammond, James May. Talk me through those two businesses and sort of how the selling of those came about.
So with Beamly, the idea was to reinvent TV. So with iPlayer, it was taking the stuff you watched on telly last night and let you watch it today on your phone or on your computer. But it's the same programs that were ever made. What about if you could interact with the programming? This was really in the days before TikTok and the earlier days of YouTube. So the broadcasters resolutely still want to make the same programming, but why can't you interact with it? So our idea was an interactive app that you could connect with the program you're watching. It would be like Twitter syncs with TV with the program guide, and it was very clever. We analyzed the subtitles to bring you relevant things, probably perfect in the time of AI. And we got, you know, very nice investment from broadcasters and so on, and the idea was they would really changed their programming to evolve, but they didn't really change the programming, and our app morphed with time, and then eventually we sold it to Coty, the brand, because actually we developed really good integration with brands around programming and so on. So that was a fine exit. And then, you know, as a founder, you then go lie on the couch at home and you think about what to do next. And one of the problems with a founder, you're probably unemployable because you don't want to work for anyone again. And your resume is a bit all over the shop. So thought what to do next, and then thought about creating Six Tribes, which is the idea is on Twitter. It's a bit of a mess because it's really, you know, there's a lot of unpleasant conversation. Why? Because everyone wades in and is unpleasant. But if you could create tribes of like-minded people. So we created this concept. It was a small team and built an app. And initially the growth was a bit slow. You'd log in with Facebook and you could join tribes, and we connect with your Facebook profile to find the perfect tribes for you, and used AI in the days before AI was a thing. But then people told us, you know, if I log in with Facebook, I may as well just use Facebook. So can I have anonymous login? And so we created anonymous login. And by the way, the top tribes at this time were all related to cars. They were fantastic. It was great. You'd go down the street, you'd see a car, you posted, you instantly got zillions of likes. It really resonated. And there were many other sectors that resonated as well. But then we added anonymous sort of phone login, and suddenly the traffic took off. But it took off amongst LGBT, LGBTQ, LGBTQ+, pansexuals. We learned a lot. And I had to say to the team, you know, traffic is taking off. Do not open our app on the tube because it's probably a dick pic. But team, do we want to follow the traffic or do we want to rein it in? And they all said, let's follow the traffic. It became a bit uncomfortable for our shareholders, and when an opportunity to sell arose, it made sense to do so, given that apart from that segment, the other hot segments were cars, and that was a fine exit as well. So
interesting. I mean, you obviously could have had conversations or topics or tribes across every different potential topic or sector going. What do you think it was about cars or the automotive industry that resonated so much if you maybe weren't specifically going after that customer?
I think it's really interesting because many companies look to create social communities for their audience, their users. And the thing that one of the many things I learned from Six Tribes is that moderation of communities is super important. And you think moderation is just removing the really bad people, the spammers and others. And it turns out that for the most part, there are not many of them and you can get rid of them easily. The more challenging problem is to remove the meh content. So you'd have one on, you know, Michelin restaurants, and then somebody would post, you know, their Pret lunch or something. It's not terrible, they meant well, but you know, you need to get rid of it. And so it was really the moderation. And I think the moderators on many of the car things had great audiences in other places, and they could find this was a focused place for their audience, and it just really worked well. I mean, cars wasn't the only segment, there are many others that took off as well.
Amazing. Did you get to meet the Top Gear guys when you sold through them or sold to them?
Well, actually, my business partner took care of that side of things. But, I mean, we've met in the past at BBC and so on, yeah.
Yeah, amazing. Awesome. So let's talk about community. The Sea Legals platform is where you can go and get your legal sorted for your fundraising, your selling of a business, potentially your employee contracts, pretty much everything to do with the legal side of running a business, especially at an early stage. But something which most, if not all, of your community, your member, your customers love about Sea Legals is the WhatsApp groups.
Yes.
Talk me through how that came about. And same question, how do you moderate that?
Yeah, it's a great question. So when we started Seed Legals, we had no idea whether our platform would be like the AWS of legals. We'd have lots of programmers and never talk to a human, or it would turn into a law firm with a fancy website where really people needed lawyers. And I desperately didn't want to do that. I'm a tech product guy. I want to build a platform. But it quickly became apparent that people want to talk to a human. And so what's interesting is the platform does all the heavy lifting. And if you know what you want, that's just perfect. But often you don't know what you want. And the other thing I realized very quickly is that people sometimes think they need a legal agreement. But what they really want is they want advice. How do I do a pitch deck? How do I find investors? What are the key deal terms? So one of the things I like to do at Seed Legals, and I was joking about, think, what does a law firm do? Let's do completely the opposite. But, you know, the developer or the product person in me hates doing anything more than once. So every time there's a problem, the third time there's a problem to be solved, let's write an article. Let's create a product on the platform. Let's make a video. Let's update the hint text. So we can offer, in the software eats the world way of doing things, a solution. And community is one way of doing that. So, you know, if there are 500 people in a community and somebody asks a question and you can answer the question in a way that helps them and helps everyone else, it's a scalable solution. So, you know, also in the, you know, do the opposite of a law firm. A law firm, the product is a contract. But actually, the contract is just the solution, a tiny part of the solution to a problem. It's how do I find the investor? How do I get valuation? How do I make a pitch deck? All of these things. So if we can help with all of that, and by the way, we'll build the contract for you. That's the boring bit. We'll sort that, and AI will do that even more later. So, yeah.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I remember when I was putting my first employee contracts together, and I had so many questions. I was a young entrepreneur myself. I didn't have a clue where to start outside of potentially receiving a couple of these contracts myself before. So the first thing you kind of do is try and find a lawyer. I think I spent best part of £2,000 putting together these boilerplates. And to be fair, I still use those contracts today with some small changes I can make myself. But actually, there were better solutions out there when I first started. But at the time, you know, you do just think, oh, I need that advice. I need a person to speak to, because I am a person, I'm an entrepreneur who just wants to pick up the phone and say, hey, I have this problem or I need this solution, please help. Whilst potentially just having a one size fits all, which is not Seed Legals in the sense of there is that human element to it, is so invaluable. And have you found that from feedback?
Yeah, so I think two things. Number one, on the documents themselves, you know, it's easy enough to find a template on the internet. The problem is the template isn't useful. It's the information that you add to it to customize it for you. And to think about, you know, the way I think about legal contracts is you've bought a car, there's a manual in the glove box, the car breaks down somewhere in the countryside. You open the manual and it's meant to have the solution to the problem. And that's the point with a contract. If something goes wrong, you open the contract, look at it, and if it's got a solution, that's great. And if it doesn't, you're screwed. It was a bad contract. So it is also, before a problem arises, you look at it and it explains what's going to happen. So one of the nice things, I think, at Seed Legals is because of the volume of things, of contracts, we see everything. And every time something doesn't work, there's a founder fallout and the agreements didn't contemplate that sort of thing. Just like a car manufacturer, you know, engineering a better and better car because the machines build more of them, we can improve the contract. So what I love is that the contracts foresee things you never even thought of. So if you do a funding round, we've included provisions called, for example, you snooze, you lose, which means if investors don't respond, this is a current, often a problem. You have to get investor consent for something. They've gone AWOL. They don't like you. They're skiing, whatever. They don't respond and you're screwed. But with you snooze, you lose, it says, you know, if they don't respond in 15 days, their, you know, acceptance is deemed. Or, you know, there are various other ones that you can sell your shares at any time as a founder and you pay any 10% capital gains tax to give you those permissions. So to build in the things you didn't even think you knew, and that's the bit I love. It's a bit more difficult to sell the concept to people, but when things go wrong or things go right and you open the agreement and you've contemplated it, that's what I love. Mm-hmm. Just coming back to the community side, And as a general thing for anyone watching this, I'm recently to learning the terms of CLG and PLG, community-led growth and product-led growth. So product-led growth is you build it and you hope they come, which is nice, but might not happen. Or maybe you've got a fantastic product, but no one knows about it. Community-led growth is where you identify a community and you immerse yourself in that community. And in some cases, it's easier. I mean, if you're selling insurance to SMEs, there's probably not much of a community. But if you are a TikToker or you're doing, you know, there are many things. You're selling tea. There's tea societies or the people who love tea. They're going to hang out in certain places. And if you can immerse yourself and sometimes create that community, that gives you a major network effect where your customers are, if they like you, selling for you. So the community part is great for mentoring and also great for creating that sort of coming together. And I think London startup events and so on are the high point of that as well, where you network and meet others as well.
100%. So let's go back to those contracts. Yeah. I love the fact you described a potential clause or a clause in some of your contracts, which is very understandable. I think that's a lot of fear around legal contracts is terminology, wording that people don't understand. You snooze, you lose. I think a lot of people use that phrase quite often. It's very easy to understand. And then, of course, yeah, 100%. If you are in a situation where you need an answer from an investor, you don't want to be locked into not being able to make a decision quickly, yeah. Which for most startups is what you need to be doing very frequently. So I love that. But let's talk about potential issues. When you were first starting Seedly, you've been doing this for 7.5+ years now, year one or year two, did you ever have any issues with the legals that potentially your customers use, which you went, oh gosh, I really wish I hadn't had that clause in there, or, you know, those really tough challenges which are related to the core of your business?
It's a great question. I'm delighted to say, fortunately, we didn't. I think, you know, a few things. Number one is, obviously, when we launched, we hadn't built the entire platform. So there was a subset of features. But also, you know, one of the key problems any founder has is you thinking before you launch, do I need to build all the features that I've listed? You've made a list of 50 features. It's going to take you forever. Or can you build with a lot less? And I love the concept of fake it till you make it. Not Terranos style, but that is fake it till you make it means do things manually until you can automate it. So when we launched Seed Legals, we made a list of, we thought, like, 50 terms that people might need in a funding round. But we had no idea if anyone would really need it. So could we launch with a smaller set of terms? The product was going to be, the contract you got was going to be just as good. It was just going to be less flexible. And then as soon as somebody said, hey, I need preference shares, we'd like frantically code preference shares. But what we did is our in-house legal team manually did things in a Word document. So the fake it till you make it for us was there was a nice website, you'd enter the deal terms, but the platform wasn't correctly generating the documents. So our legal team would review it or just manually create the document. And eventually they're going like, Anthony, you're killing us. We need to automate this. Help. And then you'd automate it. And I think that was immensely valuable because I think whenever you have an idea for a startup product, you probably on your list, you've got twice as many things as to build as customers are actually wanting. And half the things customers really want, you haven't thought about. So you're much better off launching with a much simpler version of the product and then quickly learning the things that really they want. And if they didn't want the things that you had on your list you didn't do, that's a win. You've just gotten there much faster and spending less money getting there.
For sure. I think it's prioritization and everything from foresight as well. What about that WhatsApp? How many customers or users of that WhatsApp? They may have been a customer of yours 6 years ago and they're on this WhatsApp and they might still pay your annual fees, or, you know, maybe they're just still in that WhatsApp. How many members are there in this WhatsApp?
Well, I'm a member of quite a few Slack and WhatsApp and other groups. A good fraction of my evenings and days goes into, answering questions in groups, which I love to do. On the Seed Legals X founders group, I think there are about 500 people. I think WhatsApp's got a limit of 1,000 or something. So, and there are other ones. Another excellent group is the Anonymous Founders. So if you Google landscape.vc, Anonymous Founders, everyone's anonymous there. which means you get frank feedback on a lot of things. But it's excellent because, you know, for me, I get to see the questions that people are asking and, you know, are they recommending me or a competitor? What things are they looking for? As a founder, whether it be our WhatsApp group or others, it's fantastic to see many of the questions that others have got the same problems as you, and they're asking, what CRM system should I use? Or, you know, my bank isn't approving my account, or my bank's refused KYC. Those are the most popular ones. And then you see, you know, that you're not the only one struggling with the problem, and you'll often get a fast answer. So it's fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, I was speaking to a couple of Seed Legal's customers in preparation for this conversation, and one of them said, yeah, it was great. I asked a question and the CEO, Anthony,
yes.
replied to me, which is quite unusual, to be honest. I mean, you have a team of 160 people that could be dealing with that, but no, you're still doing the most manual task or, you know, the customer service task, which some CEOs pride themselves in doing, and some say they should run away from that task as quick as possible. What's your opinion on sort of going down into the detail and kind of getting stuck in?
It's a great question, and I haven't decided whether my doing this is a total win or a total failure as a CEO to prioritize accordingly. But firstly, I love doing it. And secondly, for me, I mean, it's obviously fantastic audience research, because the things that people are asking tells me exactly which things I should be building, which things I'm missing, where people are talking about a competitor. So there's fantastic intel. But I think one of the other interesting things is, yes, there are many people in my team who can answer questions, but often the questions that people ask are not so much the legal questions, they're what would you do as a founder? And there's nothing like a founder to answer that. I think it's always fantastic that sometimes people think I'm in Australia, because the other thing is I'm up way late at night. I usually go to bed about 3 a.m. I love listening to music and getting through emails and so on. I can't WhatsApp after about 11 p.m. because it's, you know, I don't want to wake people. You know, WhatsApp is used for your grandparents having in distress or something. So that's the problem. But Slack groups are okay. And that's when I get to things. It's like the CEO replied at 3 a.m. Actually, I was listening to some music and getting through my day. Things, I actually really enjoy that. So,
yeah, I mean, yeah. When we were arranging this, I'm pretty sure I received a LinkedIn message from you at like 3 a.m. I was like,
that would be it.
He must be traveling. It turns out you're actually in your central London home replying to me late at night.
I also get up a bit late in the morning, but don't tell my team.
Look, at the end of the day, you're building an amazing business. I read somewhere that 1 in 3 fundraising rounds from early startups use Seed Legal. Yeah. Is that right?
Yeah, it's fantastic. And it's interesting that in the initial days, you try to, you know, I mean, law firms have been doing legal agreements for and funding round docs for decades. So initially, you try to reflect what is market. But then when you've got enough people using your platform, you can now make market. And over the Christmas break, I didn't go anywhere. I spent the entire Christmas break writing up this article I've been planning to do for 2 years called Seed Legal's Termometer. So over thousands of funding rounds, we've got data on the key deal terms. So we ran the data, and for small, medium, and large rounds, we can now show you what are the market standard deal terms. And it turns out now, people are now sending these to law firms to educate the people in law firms what's market standard. And now what's, I think, quite interesting is the fact you've published this means that people will look at it and then pick that. So it also means you've got now a high bar of responsibility to show sometimes the things that people are selecting may not be the things that you think are the right things that people should be doing, because my goal, our goal at Seed Legals, is to help protect founders and investors. Investors are taking a huge risk by giving money to people on some pipe dream. Founders, of course, don't want to lose their house and home. They want a return on investment. They don't want to be screwed by investors who might, there might be an information asymmetry. The investor knows a lot more than the founder. So how do you create something that protects both parties? And that's the bit that I really love. And I think that's what drives me to be up late and in founder groups and so on, to try and, you know, initially reflect that and now increasingly shape that.
Yeah, I think it's incredible. I mean, I love the element of founder-to-founder communication in London, especially. See, that's what we're doing here today.
Yep.
How important do you think it is to have kind of a face as a CEO of a sort of tech business or let's just say any business in the ecosystem, startup ecosystem in 2024?
Well, firstly, I don't know if it's in any way unique to Seed Legals or me, but I'm amazed at the number of people who reach out to me directly, which I think is fantastic. It's our customers, it's people on LinkedIn, but particularly customers. They'll reach out to say someone in the team was awesome, or they'll reach out to say something didn't work, or they'll reach out to ask a question. At some point, it might be better that they, chat to one of my team, but it's a bit like the canary in the mine. You get early, info on what's working and what's not. And I think it's fantastic, but I don't think it's the same with every other company. And I'm amazed that that's the case. I think it's immensely valuable, and I think one of the important things for any CEO is to be as close to your customers as possible. Because one of the challenges for any, founders, some founders, are very street hustle. They know what the audience wants. And some of them might be MBAs, or they might be data scientists or something, and they're not the audience themselves, or they hate interacting with people. And one of the key things to learn is to be as close to customers as possible, and actually often to reinvent yourself. I think as a CEO, you need to constantly reinvent yourself. I don't claim success in this, I should say, but initially you may find, most founders are INTJ or INTP, the I being introvert, if you know your Myers-Briggs profiles. So you may start off being a maths guru, or an accountant, or a software developer, and you love nothing more than sitting in front of a computer coding. But you need to now sell this vision. You need to sell the vision to your customers, to your team, to your investors, and bring people on that journey. So how do you get out and learn the art of storytelling, get comfortable on stage? So years ago when I did the Myers-Briggs thing, for me it was like an INTJ, I think. And more recently it was an ENTJ. It turned into extrovert. And I think that's because, even though I love nothing more than listening to music late at night and writing emails or writing specs and so on, the job is to get out there and put yourself out there. And I think that's one of the key things that any founder needs to learn and learn to enjoy as well.
Absolutely. I think it's the fear of putting yourself out there. I think we're talking about Myers-Briggs.
Yeah.
I think I'm an ESFJ. So I got everything about me says you should be super extroverted, putting yourself out there, etc. But doesn't mean I don't get uncomfortable in certain situations, or not feel, let's say, comfortable with shouting about what my ambition is, what my dream is, what I'm working on. Likewise for you as a introvert, that actually means where you get your energy from, rather than you're hiding away like behind your computer, which I'm sure you still do at some points, right? How important do you think it is for any founder, whether they are a 20-year professional running a large corporate, right the way down to a new startup, to get their face out there and push themselves to shout loudly about their business?
There has to be somebody in the founding team doing that. And of course, most founding teams are more than one person. It's typically two, sometimes three. So it may turn out that amongst the founders, one of them is very much the back office person. They love doing the strategy and the spreadsheets, and they're not front of house. But then the other one needs to be front of house. So, by the way, if you'd like a fun aside of how I learned to, conquer the fear of being on stage. So probably about 25 years ago now, when I was CTO at a company doing real-time 3D graphics, we were one of 20 companies that Intel had chosen to present at the Web 3D Roundup, which was an event in Los Angeles. There were 3,000 people in the audience, and they were inebriated because there were pre-pitch drinks. They had whoopee cushions to make farting noises if you went over your allocated time, and if your demo crashed or you were boring, they also had ping pong guns to shoot you. Now, I had insisted in our company that I was going to do this demo. My team were in Australia. I was in Atlanta. In LA. And during the rehearsals, our 3D engine kept crashing. I had 3 minutes to talk, and I think it had lasted no more than a minute. So there were frantic calls to Australia to fix the bug ahead of this event. And the company was low on cash, so we also needed to raise funding. So sort of like the future of the company hinged on a good presentation, which had kept crashing, and I had insisted that I was going to do this presentation. So, no stress, future of the company, 3000, inebriated with a dodgy as hell 3D engine. Anyway, it turned out it worked brilliantly. We didn't win. I think we came second or third. I finished with like 1 second to spare. It didn't crash like Hero. And so now whenever I'm on stage, I go, is the future of the company at risk with a dodgy demo, which probably won't work? And are there 3,000 people who are going to shoot me with ping pong balls? And if the answer is no, I can relax. So, of course, you always want to get a suitable amount of jitters before an event, because otherwise you're not respecting your audience. But you get that reasonable comfort zone to be there and tell a story and project.
I love that. I love that. And the bit I really pick up on is having a bit of nerves is actually about respecting the audience, as you put it in your words. But I think it's also about just caring.
Exactly.
You care about the outcome. You care about what you're doing and hopefully achieving. But it's just that first time. Get out there, first, second, third time. By the time you get to the fifth time, it's going to be so much easier. What do you feel about sort of starting small to starting large? You are a founder who goes, I'm going to jump straight into that deep end and go for the top score, or you kind of, right, let's start small. We're going to go for a small, close-knit, small event and put myself out there first. What's your opinion on that?
You know, if you're starting out, you want to practice on a small event first. You want to start with friends you're going to pitch to. And if they go, dude, I've no idea what you're talking about. And then, you know, there's some excellent ones in London. You can pitch at online events or in person. There's some really great Seed Legal resources on the art of the pitch and the art of storytelling. So, you know, learn that. And, you know, it's said, if you're pitching to investors, don't pitch first to your best investor, pitch to the least likely ones. And so you'll learn quickly, you'll get feedback from the investor. And I think often when you're pitching, you can just look at the audience, and if they start glazing over, you know, they don't have to say anything. You know that you're just waffling on and you should shut up and move on. So, and then the last thing I think is, do your audience research first, because there's nothing like a mismatched pitch. So whenever I do a presentation, whether it's at a university to students or a startup group, I will always go and talk to a few people in the audience saying, what would you love to hear most today? What have you come here to learn? What stage is your business? Have you raised funding or not? And then that helps me understand who the audience is. And it also gives me some nice individualization to pick out. And I can say, I'm talking to Alice over there, you know, on her sourdough bakery or something, you know, she's, and suddenly the audience know that you're talking with them, not at them.
Love that. Yeah. Everything's about audience research, whether it be from behind a computer or in a person.
Exactly.
I've heard you say this number of times, and it's one of my favorite Anthony Rose quotes, if I can put you in that bubble now, and say that you are now being quoted, which is, if you hear a question more than three times or three times or more, yeah, write an article about, yeah, it. You also mentioned that you've written hundreds of articles. Yeah. What is the question that you have been asked the most in the last 5 years?
It would have to be something about SEIS. You know, I think one day in a future life, if I'm reincarnated, it'll be something as an AI bot answering SEIS questions. No, I mean, people often ask SEIS questions, and everyone points them my way in founder chat groups, because I know I can answer SEIS questions. Those are, you know, standard formulaic things. Generally, people want to know, how do I create a great pitch deck, and how do I find investors? The finding investors is, you know, the number one problem that most founders perceive they have. The number one problem they probably actually have is how to make a product that your customers will want, but they don't know that until they get there later.
Yeah, absolutely. I imagine SEIS is a very popular topic. Let's talk about that traction. So I'm sure a lot of businesses kind of say to you and say, hey, how much traction do I actually need before going for fundraising? Because, yeah, I know that my roadmap is going to involve some outside capital from my business. I have this great idea. Maybe we've got our first customer or handful of customers, depending on the ticket size, etc. Yeah. What's your opinion on traction?
Right. Well, I think maybe I'll rewrite that as, when's the right time to raise investment, your first investment round? So my data shows that companies or founders put a median of £26,000 of their own money into the business before they raise their first round. Why? Because no one invests on a PowerPoint. You want to see a prototype, you want to see some traction, you want to see something. So you put some money in now, when should you raise investment? And I think the point to raise investment, two conditions should be met, maybe three. One, you validated enough that people really want this, so you're not taking investor money to learn on their dime that nobody wants it. Number two, the rate at which you can grow things is limited by the rate that you can fund it yourself. So, you know, if you've been coding yourself, or you're designing it yourself because you can't afford a designer, or you've got a product but you can't market it because you haven't got a sales or marketing person because you can't afford them, you're now on the slow train. You're much better off now raising investment to make everything go much faster. It would be silly if it took you 4 years to get there when you could have gotten there in 3 years or 2 years. And the last condition to be met is that you can raise at the valuation, you can achieve the valuation that you need to raise the amount you need without excessive dilution. So you might be raising £200,000 at £1 million pre-money valuation, so you're diluting 15%, and that would be the norm. So those three conditions. So everything about startup fundraising to me is, firstly, you have an idea. Then you go get a book called The Mom Test to validate the idea, and you ask the right people the right questions. And then you might put some of your own time and money before you leave your day job into building a prototype and testing it. And you know, it's as simple as using products like Marvel or others, Figma, make a phone mock-up and show people and have them use it. I mean, it doesn't cost you much to do that. It doesn't do anything, but you can see if they don't understand it from the interface or they don't get the concept, keep iterating and either give up or iterate. And then once you've built that concept and validated, now you might raise from friends and family, you know, £50,000 or £70,000. You might use Seedfast to do that. And then you might raise £200,000 or £250,000 from angel investors. And each time, the idea is you have more data and proof point to validate what you're doing. So maybe now let me answer your question from the other way around. So let's say that you want to raise £10 million from a VC. A VC is going to want to see that you're doing £1 million a year in annual, you know, recurring revenue. And they want to see a spreadsheet that goes, a business plan and revenue numbers that go up. And they're probably less cared about what you do than the growth. If you're doubling year on year and you're doing £10 million a year revenue, they go, we're in. By the way, what do you guys do? So, but if you don't have revenue, then you have to go back a step, which is, do I have users? And if you don't have users, do I have letters of intent or signed contracts with B2B partners? And if I don't have that, what are my retention figures and validation? And if I don't have that, well, I'm just going to wave my arms and gesticulate and sell the dream. But at each point, the more validation, the more investment that you can raise at the higher valuation. And it's once you understand that formula, then I think the path becomes clearer.
The problem is you put it across so well. This is where you're going to get so many questions of people going, Anthony, how much should I raise? How should I do that? So let's talk about amounts then. Do you have an idea of how much money has been raised off the back of the legals from the Seed Legals platform over the past?
Oh, yeah, it's more than £1.5 billion has been raised through Seed Legals, yeah, and probably closer to two now, yeah.
It's incredible. What's the plan for Seed Legals in the next 5 years?
5 years is a long time. So when we started Seed Legals, it was all about Seed Legals for founders. But, you know, we've also got about 25% of all active angel investors in the UK have done investments on Seed Legals. So we've a huge investor community, and now we want to create Seed Legals for investors. And in the same way we have communities and mentor founders, we want to do the same for investors. The more investors there are that are investing and they know about their tax benefits, they know and, you know, figure out companies to connect with and so on, the more money there is available for the entire ecosystem. So as Reid Hoffman from LinkedIn said, first, build a utility. and then build a network. And that's exactly what we're doing. So Seed Legals for Investors is the big thing that we're working on now. And that includes matchmaking. So, you know, for example, maybe using AI to analyze a pitch deck to work out the segments that you might appeal to, work out the investor's DNA, and then, of course, with the company's permission, say, would you like us to find investors for you? So you're going to see a lot more of that. And then also, you know, to me, I've always been eyeing the US as the market. It's the big banana, right? But you can lose a lot of money. You can waste a lot of time and money on a US proposition. And I've never really known what the USP, what's the unique selling point in the US. The market's different. There's no SEIS. There's no Companies House. There are other players in the space. And I've been researching that. And as I've researched it, you know, it's been clear there's no Seed Legals. And so that's the other big, you know, thing for me for this year and beyond, which is a US launch.
Amazing. So as you said, there is no Seed Legals US yet.
There is none.
So logistical steps for US expansion. Of course, you always have more work to do in the UK market, but you have a very strong foothold here in the UK. The US is a massive market. Outside of potentially some flights back and forth, setting up a base there, what does that look like in practical terms for founders who are looking to take that step across the pond in terms of setting up an office, employing people, or just doing some market research?
So, you know, I keep saying I like to do everything in a scalable way. Well, there are tons of videos you can see on if you Google Seed Legals expanding to the US. So I've done a few with Daniel Glazer from Wilson Sonsini, a major US law firm that does most of the huge funding rounds in the US, on how to incorporate in the US and the things to do. And then with a company called ScaleWise and how to build your sales team and how to expand. And should you devote all of your company's resources to it or just like 1% and get the CEO to go on a plane to New York first and then work out the market. So I'm trying to both create educational content for others as well as educate myself. But I think what's interesting is once we do have a Seed Legals US, then to completely productize the I want to expand to the US, it should be just push this button and you can now get your US agreements as well. So this is a huge pain point. People are spending huge amounts of money on all the legals for the US, trying to work out a Delaware flip and so on, and all of that can be productized. Of course, you know, UK companies moving to the US is much smaller than the US market overall, but I think that founders everywhere have got substantially the same things that are problems for them. What do I do at the beginning, right? Founder agreements, because shit happens. Founders break up. If you don't have a founder agreement, it's a disaster. You know, what do I do about incorporation? What do I do about taxes? Who do I give shares to? These are fairly universal problems. And I think the same way we've a magnet for those resources in the UK, can we replicate that in the US? And of course, I don't know the answer, but that's what I'm going to learn over the coming year.
As you say, 5 years is a long time. Who knows where Seed Legals might go in that time? Let's talk about balance. You've been an entrepreneur for 15 plus years. You're a married man. You're based here in London, in the UK. It's extremely hard to be an entrepreneur running, as you are, 160 plus employee count business, manage having a healthy relationship with a partner, and maybe, who knows, have a bit of free time. How do you find that balance in the working week to do all those things you want to do outside of work?
I think my wife might give a different answer to me. I work insanely hard. I very much enjoy what I do. My days are completely filled with team and customer calls, and my evenings are pretty much filled with doing specs, emails, Slack, WhatsApp, and more. And I rather enjoy that. I do like to go for a run. One of the nice things of being in London is I run everywhere, ran here. And on the weekends, I'll go out for a run. My family, mother, brother, and sister are in Australia, so I visit them a couple of times a year. And I like to go walking in the Dolomites and so on in summer. So, you know, I hope I have the work-life balance. Well, I would say about right. Others might not. I reckon the fact I've still got hair and it's not grey indicates that it's okay. I do always say that it's a marathon, not a sprint. And I do get concerned when often you have younger team members who are clearly putting in an insane number of hours. But, you know, it sounds great. You'd like that output, but you know that it can end badly, and it can end badly either because they've just put too many hours in, or they are valuing their contribution more than others are valuing it, and that creates this asymmetry that then leads to unhappiness later.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, let's talk about that then, specifically about culture. It's of course a topical conversation around remote work, hybrid, full-time in the office, right the way through to instilling a good work ethic, culture with breeds happiness. Did you have any idea of how to do that when you were starting Seed Legals? Like, talk me through that. How has that expanded over the course of the last 7 years?
Well, I mean, I've been around in other companies, including the BBC before, so I wasn't starting quite from scratch. But I think the big thing that, you know, threw a spanner in everyone's works was COVID, where one day it's like, team, you need to work from home from now on. And the question was it going to screw up everything? And it turned out at Seed Legals, nobody batted an eyelid. I mean, we were always interacting on Slack and so on. So the fact that people were at home made actually not the slightest difference. And many, you know, much of our days on calls with customers, which was always on Zoom anyway. So, but then, you know, for me, I've always wanted to build a team. I've insisted on building a team that you had to be in the office. Clearly, that was now a bit of a seismic shift because it worked when nobody was in the office. So what is the new norm? Do you go fully remote? Do you insist people back in the office? And what I figured quite quickly is my goal is to provide a great office environment that you can be in if you want to and you're not forced to be in. And then let's just use data and see how often people want to come in. And I think people are in maybe like 2 days a week or something like that. We now have the, you know, irony that if everyone comes into the office can only seat about a third of the whole team. But, you know, it doesn't make sense to get a bigger office because every time I go in, it's partially empty. So you've got this strange balance. I think the tech team would prefer to never come in, and our sales and support team are much more gregarious and want to be in. So at the moment, I'm not forcing it. Interestingly, though, I still hire people who are in the UK and could plausibly be in the office a couple of days a week, even though they don't have to be. So I haven't got as far as hiring people in other countries, and I'm not quite sure whether I feel it's just a culture thing or, you know, there's the aspiration that we may be in the office more. But I think it works quite well.
Do you have any offsites? Do you have team away days? How are you still trying to keep that culture? Okay, maybe not 5 times a week in the office, but people still want to mostly be around other people. And obviously that's something which you've had for the majority of your career, being around people every single day in the office. Do you do anything sort of like that?
Absolutely. And I think it's usually each team. I mean, they're going to have a budget for pubs and away days and evenings and dinners and things like that. So generally each team will self-organize a combination of office days and out days. I see the invoices for the leisure activities. So, so absolutely the idea is, you know, sometimes at a company level, we had our Seed Legals Mission and Values Day, kindly hosted by HSBC, you know, Innovation Banking at their fabulous venue. We're on the rooftop and we had speakers and so on. It was a great event. That was like a company event, but usually, you know, when you're 160 people, organizing a company event is a major undertaking. So it's usually at a team level.
Amazing. Let's talk content. So over the past year, you've been on more podcasts, you've been pushing out your own message, your own story, but of course promoting Seed Legals more. You also, my understanding of seeing you more frequently, shifting the focus around doing more events. Talk me through that process of maybe going from maybe more of a traditional marketing mindset into this 2024 LinkedIn focused content creation for Mr. Anthony Rose.
Great point. So I've always thought that content marketing is incredibly valuable and a missed opportunity for most startups. So what is content marketing? Content marketing is when, you know, you and your team write articles about the things that you are passionate about and knowledgeable about. This is firstly excellent SEO. The more such articles you have, the more people will find you. And when they find you and they see you're a source of knowledge, they're going to come to you. Also, these articles are very helpful for your own team because it will tell them the answers to questions. So if, you know, this is in my mantra of the third time someone asks, write an article. So if people keep asking us about SEIS, You know, can you raise EIS after 7 years? Well, instead of team members keep having to write the same thing, if they can just point to an article, and then one day AI is going to find that article. So right from the beginning, I was obsessed with writing articles. It's thought leadership, it's SEO, it's knowledge, and it's just plain helpful for your user base. And if you're any company and not creating articles, I think you've got a great missed opportunity. And one of my customers sells green tea, and I was on their site, they got beautiful pictures of green tea, but I was amazed they didn't have articles on what's the perfect boiling, you know, water temperature and how the tea is picked and what's the difference between a first and second flush and a third flush Darjeeling and so on. They had none of that. I would have spent way more time on their site had they had that. So I started out creating articles, but then articles are a huge amount of time to write, so videos are easier to create. So I found a couple of things. Firstly, whenever I would get on a call with somebody who was a domain expert at something that I thought was helpful for us and for our customers, I will usually say to them, how about we do a webinar together? So, for example, I found my team had hired a LinkedIn marketing expert for doing LinkedIn outreach, who we paid quite a lot of money to. I thought, hang on a second, I'll call this person and see, can we do a webinar together? For me, it's, of course, thought leadership and helping our customers. For you, it's lead gen and establishing yourself as a known authority. And so I do probably one every week or two of somebody, whether it's building a sales team or expanding to the US or, you know, any number of things, cybercrime. I learned a lot from the cybercrime one. So that's one piece. And the other one is, also in the, you know, scalable things, I usually just wake up one day and have a passion to just do an article on some random thing. Sometimes my SEO team say, dude, pick more useful things. But it's, you know, my current one, which I need to, I've done half the research on, is which SIC code is right for you. So when you incorporate your company on Companies House, there are these SIC codes, which say the industry sector you're in. These were mostly made in the 1930s, and they're like a whole lot of them for what type of milling operations or mining, and there's like three for the internet. So, you know, actually there's 700 codes, but actually only like 10 of them are 50% of all startups. So just using Seed Legal's data, there's a fun article. It has almost no useful value, but there's a fun article. So I'm going to write an article on that. But, you know, I really enjoy it. So, yeah.
I love that. I've definitely noticed that before. I think I've incorporated a good handful of businesses over the past sort of 5-6 years and probably about a company a year at this point. And yeah, my it was a CIC code is I think professional services right the way through to just like internet,
exactly.
Is very broad topics for what I've been doing or what I've been up to, whilst if I was in manufacturing I would have a very detailed understanding
exactly
of what my business was doing. Yeah. So yeah, I
and the other point of my article say, don't waste your time on this because it's a rubbish thing. You can pick anything that's vaguely in the right space and nobody's going to care, so don't spend time on it.
Love it. Well, Anthony Rose, you have been my everyday founder. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of The Everyday Founder. If you haven't already, like or subscribe wherever you are watching or listening to this episode. If you know of an incredible founder that story needs to be shared, then let me know who you would like to see next on The Everyday Founder by the comment section or messaging me on LinkedIn. These episodes are brought to you by Shake Content, your LinkedIn content agency. So please show them support on all socials so that we can keep bringing you amazing guests and sharing their stories on The Everyday Founder.